International Diplomatic Student Association is Hungary-based student organization for university students interested in political science, multilateral treaties, and intergovernmental relations. IDSA podcast aims to educate its listeners on career opportunities to university students in Hungary, opening their minds to pressing social and geopolitical issues. The podcast is recorded with the support of EPA Radio. Hello, everyone. This is IDSA podcast series. Today we are having Dmytro Tuzhansky, who is a political analyst, founder of the Institute for Central European Strategy think tank, and also a co-founder of online travel journal Varosh about Transcarpathia. I'm Anna, a professional course coordinator at International Diplomatic Student Association.
And I'm Teresa, vice president for professional affairs at IDSA.
And I'm Dmytro. Thank you for the invitation. Jovana Podkivanok. Hello to everyone.
So, Dmytro, you have finished Kiev Mohyla Academy with master's degree in political science and European studies. How did you decide to become a political scientist?
It's an interesting story. Thank you for this question. To be honest, I am from the typical Ukraine family, but so of engineers. And when I was in the 11th form at school, I was very much confused where I should enter and who I should be in the future, what type of profession I should choose. And it was very funny because I was really good at school, you know, it's this number one top list in almost subjects. And then I decided to become a political analyst. In that time, it was like something new, something fresh. But my parents were very skeptical, especially my father. He told me, haha, you are not going to do anything in your life just to talk. I said, no. I'm going to be the best political analyst in this country. Luckily, I was good in history, so the main subject you should pass to enter the university for political, to become a political analyst, it was history. I got third prize in this subject, Olympiada. Do you know this? We have in Ukraine the same. So I entered the university without any kind of exams and even just without the conversation as well. Just I come, present my diploma, just a piece of paper, and this is how I entered the university. Much more difficult it was with master's degree because I had to change the university. I got bachelor's degree in Dragomanos University. It's not the best university in Ukraine, but not the worst as well, especially due to this political science department. I got very nice knowledges, and it helped me to enter Kyiv Mohyla Academy, the best university in Ukraine, without any problems. I was in the top list due to their entire ratings. But to be honest, after the university, it was, after I got the master's degree, it was a debate inside me what I should do next, to get a PhD, to travel abroad, to enter another university. It was very popular in my time to get master's degree outside the country, or to try to get the PhD as well. But I decided to test my knowledges. So in field, I started working. It was political consulting mainly. Then it was advertising. And only 8 years ago, I came back to political science or political analysis. Right now it's my main job.
So was there a particular internship or a breakthrough moment during your university years which helped you realize that you really want to become a political scientist?
To be honest, I never hesitated after that decision at school that I'm going to be the political scientist. The only problem was that this profession so is not in such demand in Ukraine that I expect. I mean that this wrong understanding of what does it mean to be the political analyst. So because it's not to be the PR manager, it's not to be the political commentator, it's not to be the political journalist or observer, political analyst. It's like to be the mathematic guy. You have to count, you have to plus, minus, to create assessments. So it's very, very strict, let's say, science knowledge. And the problem is that why I actually got expertise in media and, for example, in political observation, it's a little bit in direction to the, I don't know, some side direction, because it gave me, you know, the more possibility to work as a political analyst, but as a media analyst, as a, you know, I was very good in advertising. I was the copywriter, so it's good to, so it was good practice because I worked with Discovery Channel, for example, or with Microsoft, or many beer companies. Don't want to count, you know, to advertise alcohol. The key moment was actually at school when I was in Olympiada, in this subject Olympiada in Chernigov. It was announcement of the results, and one of the professor was responsible for each task in that whole task in the Olympiada, and I got the highest mark in one of the tasks. And one professor who was responsible for that task, he named me and then said that it's strange that you got so high mark in this task, because in other tasks you got just zero. It means that you are not so good in history, but you could be good in political scientists. For me, it was like, you know, the sign from the heavens. And from that, from when I was 16 or 17, so no doubt, I'm political analyst, 100%.
So, as Anna mentioned in the beginning, you created Varos Travel Journal in Transcarpathia. What sparked an interest to create it? And do you think that this project contributes to the improved relations between ethnic Hungarians and Ukrainians in the region?
At first, it was just for fun, to be honest. And in that time, I needed independent laboratory where I could, you know, create different sort of experiments, media experiments, to get really independent experience on media, on audience, on monetization, so on and so on. Yes, the niche of Varos is to discover and to reopen Transcarpathia or Subcarpathia or Carpathoi. It doesn't matter, because this region is very interesting due to its history and belongings to not just to different states. What is interesting with Zakarpattia, with Transcarpathia, because Ukrainians, Hungarians, Jews, even Germans, Slovaks, Romanians could say that this is their native land. And this is, it's not a problem, it's not a challenge, it's like a treasure, it's a heritage, because it's the land and the region where people for, I don't know how many years, they live in peace. And this is the main, I think, the main idea of Zakarpattia is to show an example, because it shows an example, how people of different nationalities, religious languages could live together without, you know, very big conflicts during centuries. So Varos is about this. So come to Zakarpattia and feel this mix of everything: food, culture, dresses, clothes, mountains, all these languages. So it's like, you know, it is not the part of the EU, but it's like the quintessence of this idea, so of the EU, kind of the representation of this big family of different cultures, different states, different nations. So best place you should travel to next year. Oh, this year, sorry.
Well, if we will be able because of the pandemic now.
Really,
but surely will in future.
Yeah.
So in addition to your political analyst experience, in addition to your media studies, you're also a certified elections observer. So can you compare elections taking place worldwide? What are processes in the Russian Federation, Norway and Moldova? How are elections different? What are the criteria for evaluating the fairness of elections?
So at first, I really recommend to everybody who is studying international affairs or international relations, try to follow this track of activities. If you will have a chance to be like a certified observer, like I am, you mean to pass trainings. First, it was in Belgrade, Serbia, probably in 2015 or 2000. Yes, 2015. So probably it could look like a very boring issue because you should, you know, count ballots, follow different, I don't know, procedures, legislation, all this monitoring, and that's it. It's not true. International observation is very interesting in case especially of self-control, of following code of conduct, standards, best practices, and the best worldwide legislation on how to conduct elections. It's hard to compare because I was really two missions in Russia, in Moldova, in the Norway. Norway is still the best democracy in the world. It's really paradox because they still have a monarchy. The main party still is left party. But in the beginning of first part of 20th century, when in post-Soviet region or even in the central Europe, this left-wing processes followed to totalitarianism and so on. In Norway, it followed and ran for deepening democracy. And, you know, right now, it was nothing to observe, to be honest, in Norway. In case of any violations, it was just a mission like a study trip, because we observe how people in Norway follow all rules, follow how machines counting ballots, and the election process in Norway is organized in the such high level that you are double checking not for looking any kind of violations or mistakes. You are looking for to be sure that this wheel of person you count right. You know, every ballot double checks almost if it's not clear, because the system in Norway that you could go to the polling station with your own ballot. So they are distributing freely. You have a ballot, you come to, you could take your ballot everywhere, in a shop, in the post office. You go to the police station with the ballot, and each ballot means that you support a specific party. So you take a ballot of your party you are supporting. So it's so interesting of system. You have a ballot like a copybook. You don't even need to put a stick. Regarding Moldova and Russia, very similar in case of violations, so a lot of violations. In case of organization of elections, Russia is better, still better. But this is more a question of money. And another question, Russians want to control, so they need to organize everything properly. So it's not because of democracy, the following of procedures, so on and so on. It's because of control. In Moldova, and the same in Ukraine, we have a little bit much more mess. But it's because of democracy and transition, let's say. Problem of Moldova was named 5 years ago, if I'm not wrong, a captured state. It means that it was even the problem with this mess. Mess means not the democracy, so even in transition that we have in Ukraine, but democracy like under the threat. So, but last presidential election in Moldova showed that so Moldovan democracy is still so alive, and hope so. I think it will be snap elections, parliamentary one this year, but we'll see.
So moving back to Ukrainian-Hungarian relations, according to the Embassy of Ukraine to Hungary, there are 160,000 Hungarians in Ukraine. And at the time when Ukraine was becoming an independent state, it was of a crucial importance for Hungary to sign a declaration on security of the national minorities' rights. There is even a Ukrainian-Hungarian commission that monitors the security of national minorities. And in October 2020, Ukrainian local elections were saddened by the scandal between two countries. Ukrainian Minister of Foreign Affairs banned the entrance of two Hungarian officials to Ukraine due to the agitation to vote for a party of ethnic Hungarians. And Euroactive reported that Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó questioned Ukraine's willingness to adhere to its duties to protect Hungarian minorities within its border after the Ukrainian Security State Services, and I'm quoting right now, raided enterprises of ethnic Hungarians, and that was considered to be an intimidation. Mitro, in your opinion, did Ukrainian side overreact in this situation? Was it a bit of a witch hunt? And what steps have to be taken to normalize the relations between the two states? How to take the heat off from Hungarian-Ukrainian relations?
I'm really upset of the second part of 2020 regarding the Hungarian-Ukrainian relations and these negotiations, because it looked in the middle of summer that both countries were very close to come over and deal with this conflict. It was a preparation of the meeting, a high-level summit between Zelensky and Orban, the leaders of two states, but then everything went in the wrong way. Regarding that incident with interference or meddling in Ukraine elections, it was the base on that claims, because due to Ukraine legislation, if you are the foreigner, you couldn't agitate in our elections. I mean, in Ukraine elections, it's Article 50 or 52, I'm not wrong, but it is clear. So no, this misunderstanding or misleading or misinterpretation, it's clear. Due to my information, Ukraine side tried to inform a few times the Hungarian side. But, something was wrong in that period of time, because I wrote about the same case 1 year ago. So Hungarian officials, due to my investigation and due to my interpretation, meddled in the Ukraine parliamentary elections already. In that time, it was just a media scandal without banning of entering any officials. And I said in that time to my Hungarian colleagues that be careful, guys, because this time, luckily, we avoid very, very bad results. But next time it will be worse. And they said, you are just kidding, or the year after, we had a very, I think it is the lowest level in bilateral relations, because I think it is when, Ukraine, or it could be from the Hungarian side, and when you ban the entering of top official of your neighbor, it means that, so it is very bad. We have very serious problems. But moreover, it was not just this accident with this interference into elections. It was also the operation of the security service of Ukraine against Hungarian institutions. It was in the end of November. It's another spike of this escalation. And for example, right now, the leader of Hungarian minority of Ukraine and of Zakarpattia, he's now in Budapest. He's a Ukrainian citizen who had to move outside the country, because it is already two cases against him with very serious topics, so that he betrayed the state. And it's the case of separatism as well. So very, very serious, investigations. But still, it is question of the proofs, real proofs. So these last tensions, it's a very good mirror of relations between Ukraine and Hungary for the last 3 years. So very serious problems. And we have spikes, we have these come downs, but the problem is that both sides, we don't work how to manage all this sensitive, you know, topics, issues, and how to find the solutions. And still, we have a big agenda of sensitive topics, but have no solutions. So dual citizenship, interference into elections, of Hungarian institution and of Hungarians' money, question of Hungarian autonomy, question of using national symbols, flags, all the signs and so on, the role of the security service of Ukraine, the question of Hungarian separatism, and, you know, more and more. So, and it looks like that we are going around the circles. One more circle. So right now, nothing new, the same, but no solutions. What it could be done, you know, it's simple because, you know, it's simple and not. Because to solve all these problems, it's not so difficult because we have an experience or such tensions between Hungary and Romania, Hungary and Slovakia, Hungary and Serbia. And I think what should be key issue that Ukraine and Hungary, they should divide this Hungarian issue, so in Ukraine, from Russia, this issue. Because, for example, why it's so difficult in Ukraine? Because Russia started war against Ukraine using minority issue, using that we protect Russian-speaking people, we protect Russians, and so on and so on. And on the other hand, Hungary so is telling the same. But the intention of Hungary is another one. It's not imperialistic one. It's EU cases, yes? So we have to divide these two cases and to follow all the best practices that was in Hungarian-Romania relations and other countries in our way, I mean the Ukrainian way, to EU, so and NATO. So from my point of view, dual of citizenship with EU and NATO member state, it is the strong interest of Ukraine. So it is not a threat. To allow Hungarians to study, so in their native language at schools, it is strong interest of Ukraine to keep this minority in the states. So it doesn't mean any kind of assimilation and so on and so on. So we have to put this EU and NATO framework into this Hungarian-Ukraine tension and to solve one problem to another problem. To be honest, if we could deal in this way, it is enough 6 months. Meeting with Zelensky and Orban, cut some stripe and, you know, to open, I don't know, road or the football stadium at least, and it will be nice.
Nice. Just to follow a little bit on the education policies. So apparently, as just to give a bit more context for our listeners, Hungarian side had a problem with Ukrainian education policies, with introduction a little bit more of Ukrainian languages in the state school curriculum. For example, for Russian-speaking schools, 80% of its curriculum had to switch to Hungarian starting from secondary schools, while for the schools with EU language studies, such as Hungarian, only 20% of Ukrainian language had to be introduced to elementary schools. Then it had to raise up to 60% of Ukrainian curriculum starting from the fifth grade. Do you happen to know if there was a discussion of this issue between foreign ministers of Hungary and Ukraine during their meeting in late February? And do Hungarians still seem to oppose this rule or not really?
First, language issue is very sensitive and emotional thing for both states. For Hungarians and for Hungary and for Ukraine as well. And what is also paradox, I think that in this case, both nations and both states should have much more this empathy to each other than they have right now. Because if you check the history of Hungary and the history of Ukraine and the history of the Hungarian language and the Ukrainian language, it's almost the same. The whole history, it's a struggle to survive. The same. That's why it's so emotional thing. Second, yes, Ukraine adopted the new legislation on education. It was in September 2017. And it was a typical for Ukraine. It's a pity mess during the adoption, because it was, the law was changed inside the parliament. So it was one project of the law, and then when this hearing inside the parliament started, it was some changes, and the final version of the law was published just 5 years after it was adopted. So it was a big scandal, and not so many people in that time knew what exactly was in that seventh article, the language article. It was a strong disinformation from Russia. Yeah, it was. Then that's why you could Google still many misunderstandings that Hungarian or Russian schools are going to be closed, and so on, that you couldn't speak in your native language at school. Then it was done few good steps, I think. I'm very skeptical on all this recommendation of Venice Commission, so as usual, but on this case, the Ukrainian-Hungarian case or this educational case, that recommendations were very good. So it was really kind of an algorithm what Ukraine should do to not just to calm down everybody, but to really improve the law. So Ukraine excluded from this language article of private schools. For example, right now in Ukraine, if you have a private school, you could study in any language you want. Second, Ukraine postponed for 3 more years till 2023. This transition period of this seventh article, when you should change the time of learning or studying in the Ukrainian language. What's still the problem? That Hungarian minority, and this is the true, and this is true, that they feel that they have less. This is the problem. That it's more like a feeling. So right now I talked to Hungarians, and it was also mentioned by Peter Vsierto, so in Kiev, he mentioned that, okay, we understand that you are not going to change this law, but let's talk about implementation. Because, and he said very rational thing, if you study in your native language, the Hungarian language, till fourth class, and from the fifth class, you have to study chemistry, so it's hard to switch from Hungarian language into Ukrainian language, especially in chemistry. You know, I remember my lessons in chemistry. It was, you know, it blowed my mind totally in Ukraine already, and to change the language is difficult. That's why I think it's a key moment right now. We should calm down, both states. We should cut this Russian disinformation about all this, you know, assimilation, junta, fascism, and so on. It's crazy because it's out of the reality. And we should both work on with this implementation of this article, how to help Hungarians, Romanians, Russians as well, through the language integrate into society. One good example, I was to Page a few days ago, and I visited a Croatian minority school, and they are running according to the same model that Ukraine proposed to Hungarian minority. The only problem is, and the only, another picture is that Croatian minority in Hungary, they have a very strong support from Hungarian government. That's why I think that solution could be one more solution from Ukraine's side. Good implementation of this law. Very... friendly to minority. Second, Ukraine state should show a strong support, even with money, donation for teachers, property issues, for minority, to show that, take a look, we really so appreciate that you are here, and we see that you are like our partners, the same citizens as, you know, Ukrainians, Romanians, and so on, others. So we need to switch this topic from this conflict issue to EU and NATO issue, to cooperation, engagement, and I think it will be good.
Nice. Thank you so much. That is a very thorough response.
So you have mentioned that you have a huge experience with media communication, and you regularly publish articles on international affairs. So what do you think that defines freedom of speech?
If you are not thinking or changing your words or sentences in case of any threats, so if you are writing freely, it means that it's, you know, freedom of speech. But it's also important that when you write, you should follow this, you know, not the best standards, but the key standards of the journalism. You should provide the facts, the evidences, and you should provide different sides, different angles to any topics. For example, my experience when I started writing from the early beginning of this conflict between Budapest and Kyiv, it was like every article, it was the massive of, you know, blames so addressed to me. And it was from both sides. Of Hungarians blamed me that I'm an agent of SBU and I want to assimilate them. Ukrainians blame me that I'm an agent of Orban and I want to provide this Hungarian autonomy. And I was happy because I was in the middle. Okay, I'm really neutral in this case right now. What is good that for the 3 years, both sides right now inviting me to different conferences, debates, and so on, so on, to ask me for this neutral view or like assessment on this problem, because they understand, because less emotions, more orations, that they understand that everybody needs solutions. That's why it's a key moment. So if you have enough arguments, enough contrasts of arguments, and these different angles on the topic or the issue, and you could operate so analytically with this, it means the freedom of speech or freedom of media.
And in your opinion, how can Ukrainian and Hungarian news outlets contribute to the normalization of Ukrainian and Hungarian relations?
Hard topic, because it's the question of independent medias. And I think Ukraine and Hungary have very big problems with this. But still, both sides could do, and they should start just from like introducing, you know, it's like a dating. We need, both states should start from the, let's say, even blind dating. Yeah, just start telling their audience about another side. From simple, just what is the size of Ukraine and Hungary, borders, I don't know, traditions, food, wine. So just start from the early beginning. Like, you introduce yourself to your, you know, future good neighbor.
Okay. So most recently, Ukrainian president decided to shut down cable television channels that are believed to be affiliated with the Russian Federation, and particularly to receive funding from there. European Federation of Journalists and International Federation of Journalists has reported on these issues, and in particular, International Federation of Journalists was concerned with all of those journalists that were employed at those channels and were raising doubts regarding the issue. Is shutting down of channels by the presidential decrees a sign of growing totalitarianism in Ukraine, in your opinion?
No. To shut down the three TV channels, it is one of the strongest and smartest decision that was made from 2014 when the Euromaidan happened, the war happened. And it is one of the most important decision in this reset of Ukraine state on state building process. So it is the strong Ukraine interest. On the other hand, it's important to understand that Zelensky, he's not following, you know, 100% the state interest. He's following his political interest, because these TV channels, they really represent Russian agenda in Ukraine. And these TV channels, they are not, it's hard to talk about independent media. They are not even the media, they are just propaganda channels. So that's why even hard to compare. I mean, it's very different levels when we are talking about freedom of speech, freedom of media, and then about these TV channels. It's far away.
But who should be the judge of what is propaganda or not? Is it for Zelensky to judge? Is it in his scope of scope capabilities?
Yeah, it's a good question. And that's why I recommend you to follow the assessment of this decision from independent media organizations in Ukraine. They are, you know, there is the unity in their assessment that it is countering disinformation measure. It's clear. The decision of Zelensky was done due to not the case of propaganda or not. It was the procedure of sanctions against this terrorist money. Because these TV channels were funded not by, for example, Russia budget money. It was money from this terrorism organization, from the Donetsk Narodna Republic and the Lugansk Narodna Republic. So due to investigation, it was money from this, gray, dark money laundering in this Donbas region. So it is different tracks. It's important to understand, but it is clear that these TV channels have nothing with, any. It's not even the case of. We are not talking about the freedom of speech or freedom of media. We it's hard even to talk about any kind of balance, because they just provide Russian agenda, the civil war in Ukraine, about the fascism, about any kind of attacks against Russian speaking people and so on. This, and they really provide the fake news about these Bulgakov books, why it was banned, and so it's relentless waves of this propaganda. This is what it's clear, but this is also a political game, because these TV channels was a strong instrument of this pro-Russian party in Ukraine, opposition, to cut off this pro-Russian, this electorate from Zelensky, and to back them to this opposition party. If you check the last ratings, Zelensky lost almost 10% of his support for the last year, especially the last half of the year, and he has no chance. For him, it's the question of political of survival, because on the one hand he has a pressure from this pro-Russian party and pro-Russia team. On the other hand, he has a pressure from this patriotic, let's say, team, the Poroshenko, who's represented. So right now it's like he's under the press. And it looks like he's going to re-election. So, on his view, I think it's the start of his new presidential campaign of this time. But, this is the history. Sometimes, or many times, very pragmatic interest of politicians help countries and states to reset and to develop its independence of sovereignty and so on. This is the typical case. Zelensky is following its very pragmatic interests. On the other hand, it's very good for Ukraine of really countering disinformation. I think it's because in this educational case we talked, it's one of the argument from Ukraine side that through this educational law we are protecting our state from Russian aggression. Okay, but it's, it's a long run. The education process, it's a long run. But it was my counter-argument. If we really want to protect our state or countering this hybrid aggression of Russia, we should start not shutting down. But shutting down, it's also an instrument, because we have this example from USA, from Latvia as well. It's a typical practice. If you could counter disinformation through balancing or through the standards or through the law, you have no chance just to shut down. That's why, democracy has to have the right to protect itself. In this case, it is this way.
But in an ideal scenario, wouldn't it be better if the Union, National Union of Journalists in Ukraine, for example, as a body, as an institution, was forbidding these channels to go live, not Zelensky?
Take a look. This, I know very well what does it mean, this unity of journalists in Ukraine. Very sad story. But before shutting down, all the three TV channels received more than 30 these violations from, we have this Nazrada.
National Council.
Yeah, which is following all these, you know, standards issues. That's why, you know, it is not that no background of this decision, but it's important. These TV channels, they still exist. They are broadcasting through YouTube. Right now, they are the most expensive YouTube TV channels or YouTube channels at all. Zelensky didn't shut down. So Ukraine as a state didn't shut down TV channels. They provide sanctions against the owner of these channels because of dirty money. So it's also typical and, you know, the case study of the democracy. We couldn't, you know, keep channels which has the finance from the terrorists. You know, it's not a question of the freedom of speech or freedom of media. You know, let's allow Al-Qaeda to finance any TV channels in Ukraine or, I don't know, in London. It's the same.
And as of right now, are any European countries or European institutions supporting President Zelensky in this decision?
U.S. supported strongly, EU supported, but in typical way that Ukraine has a right to counter disinformation, but we are following of the freedom of media so issue. And this is true. Take a look, I'm not supporting and I will be that person who will protect freedom of media in Ukraine, but me personally, I was cooperating with all the three TV channels still 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They asked me for comments. I was even in the studios of these TV channels. But when Medvedchuk bought these TV channels, so everything changed. Just one agenda, one track, one narrative. It was not the freedom of media. It was not free media. That's why, so U.S. supported, EU, I mean, Brussels also partly of supported, and we got, I mean, as a state, we got a stronger support from the states who are dealing with Russia or have a border with Russia, because they know what does it mean to have such TV channels inside the state and what does it mean.
Do you think there will be any more Euro-Atlantic support? Will the member states support a little bit more European integration of Ukraine?
Hope so. You know, it's not the question of support. I think Ukraine has a very huge expertise on dealing with disinformation, misleading propaganda, and so on, because we are a kind of a playground of all this. The question what to do with this and how to counter, because you couldn't shout everything. So we need this support of NATO or EU practice of countering disinformation. Because even right now, it's not the challenge just of Russia disinformation. We have enough disinformation inside the country. When politicians are really providing fake news, manipulations, in very sensitive topics like identity, like language, like so on. So disinformation, not just Russian disinformation, it's one of the biggest challenge so in Ukraine right now. That's why, yeah, of course, we need support, how to provide critical thinking from the schools to the universities, how to provide this double checking or so other checking standards. Yeah. We are looking for.
Nice.
As you know, our student organization, International Diplomatic Student Association, has a lot of international relations students who would like to pursue a career as a diplomat in the future. In your opinion, what does it take to become a diplomat, and what qualities young students have to possess to succeed in international relations?
I am not sure that I am going to be the diplomat. It's one of my, let's say, idea for the or a goal for the next 5 years. We'll see. But last 5 years, or already 10 years, I deal with diplomats, you know, in a daily base almost. And it's not enough to learn just the languages to become a diplomat. It's a big stereotype that I have to study not just English, but, okay, let's be Russian or German. And it's enough to be a diplomat in Germany. No, read books, follow the standards. It's a good example of Mr. Lavrov. A good example, I mean, in this. I think it was not a big debate in Hungary of the last meeting between Lavrov and Peter Sviatoslav in the Moscow, and this and undiplomatic joke of Mr. Lavrov. It was the final public discussion between two sides. And it was an interpreter of Peter Vasierto. She took a pen and then tried to fix her back. And Lavrov said, "Oh, you are going to steal our pen?" And the microphone was on air. So This is how diplomats shouldn't behave. Especially diplomats of such... how Russia presents itself, like we are, you know, second power in the world. And on the other hand, we have a good example from the US, I mean, of the new this administration. It was a good speech of Mr. Biden, the new president of the United States, who said American diplomacy so is back. It's good. So it's not a question of the personalities, it's a question of the visions, strategies. So diplomacy is back. During Trump's period, it was many times said by different analysts that the classic diplomacy so is dead. But we'll see. Right now, Mr. Blinken, Mr. Biden said that diplomacy is back. We'll see. Hope so.
So you're a founder of the Institute of Central European Strategy think tank. Do you think that think tanks can influence domestic and foreign policy in Central Europe or Eastern Europe, or if so, how?
Of course, we launched this. It's actually like NGO, but we try to run as a think tank. I'm so happy here, so in Budapest during my time here, because I met so many people who could talk and with whom I could talk about the Europe, the center of Europe. It's hard to find so many people in Ukraine, so it's a gap. And this our NGO, this our think tank, it's kind of a try to fulfill this Ukraine vision on the region, because I think Ukraine should identify itself like a center of European state, because geographically we are here in Central Europe, but in we are like out of the context, geopolitical context of Central Europe, infrastructure context of Central Europe. We have this context among Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, so even Romania. So if we take this 3Cs initiative, like a big Central Europe context, we have, you know, many states, but we have no Ukraine. It was an invitation to Ukraine, but we ignored in Ukraine. So Ukraine ignored. I think it was a big mistake. Right now, we try to manage this mistake. I think, yes, so ideas, they are not so appeared from anywhere, not in the shower or, I don't know, it needs to be the institution that will present not just ideas, good ideas, but to organize these ideas in the concepts, in the strategies and visions. So because people and persons, even strong one, very smart one, bright one, it's good, but institution is better because it's longer. It's a long-run cooperation. I think we should go this way, long-run cooperation in the center of Europe.
Amazing. So you're, I think, Visegrad fellow here in Budapest. Are you planning to bring home the expertise or the new experiences to Ukraine?
Yes, my practical result of this period in Hungary is to provide a project. It's a policy paper. What Ukraine could learn from its neighbors in the West to provide its own neighborhood policy as a part of EU and the NATO integration. So it means what Ukraine could learn from Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, Romania, Czech Republic, how to not looking for conflicts with neighbors, but how to use these good relations with neighbors for its integration. Because take a look, it's hard so far to talk about real membership of Ukraine in NATO and the EU. But when we will be in step before the real membership, we should get, as a state, the Ukraine should get yes from each country. So Hungary should say yes to Ukraine. Slovakia should say yes, not just France or Germany. So we need good relations with everybody who is inside EU and NATO, if we really want to be the part of this, you know, very nice community. I think we should.
So coming to the end of our podcast, as a final question, we would like to ask you if there are any books that you can recommend to our listeners.
Yes, now I'm reading Atlas Shrugged, the Ayn Rand. I really recommend. It's not about international affairs, but it's about how to live your life with real goals and why your life matter. I really recommend this book. I think it's the best one in 20th century, one of the best, let's say. That's it.
We are very much thanking you, Dmytro, for coming to us here. I hope our listeners got a better idea of what being a political analyst is like and would consider it as a career choice.
Thank you for the invitation and good luck. It's a good idea to create the podcast and wish you good guests, interesting discussions and many views.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.